Hi, welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Val, your host on faculty of the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my colleague and friend, the director for the Center of Western Studies, John Hodges.
The director, that does sound very impressive.
The director sounds very oppressive. How many movies have, like, the director?
Oh, yeah, that's right, the bad guy, the snidely whiplash guy.
Don't infuriate the director.
Oh, you don't want to do that. That's right. Well, good to see you, Jack.
Good to see you, sir.
Uncle. I give, okay? I give.
You tap what, out.
What is this? I tapped out. What is this millennial that I keep hearing so much about?
Yes,
this bizarre creature called a millennial.
Modern-day Sasquatch.
Exactly. And, well, he's a ubiquitous Sasquatch, from what I understand. He's everywhere, so I have to keep turning around. In fact, we have students here, of course, every year, and, of course, they are what are called millennials. But I would love to pick your brain a little bit about it because you, I guess, are technically one yourself, right?
An older one, yes.
You don't have any horns or strings. I mean, I don't speak entirely
in strange languages.
Yeah. What kind of a creature is a millennial anyway? It looks to me like they can't be too strange because you're one. But I'm an old man, see? I don't understand these things. I'm just standing here on my lawn saying, get off my lawn, you millennial types.
We forgive you.
You
anyway.
Cheeky millennials. What are you doing? So anyway, I would love to sort of figure out what we're talking about when we say millennials, because we're, you know, you and I deal with them all the time in our student body. And are there characteristics that we need to be aware of? Are they no more different than any other generation? What goes on with millennials?
Yeah,
how would you even approach a question like that?
Yeah, well, for me, the question's important because as educators, currently our student body is regularly millennials. The center's been going on for eight years now.
Yeah.
That means within that time frame, technically speaking, every student we've had falls within the millennial category. I'm doing teaching assistantship at the University of Memphis here. All my students are technically millennials.
Yes.
All right,
Jacob. Sure.
They're younger millennials, which there is a distinction between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So it matters to us because the kind of generation you're teaching doesn't change the content of what you teach, but it may change the way you go about
Absolutely.
It, the way you present
Absolutely.
Yourself. I'm flattered you want to pick my brain about it. I'm often just as curious as you because I hear all kinds of bizarre things about us, I guess. I say us. I almost want to resist any sort of homogenization like milk. If I was to approach this, the structure I would use is I would want to first of all give, I guess, like a technical definition, which is very simple and short. I mean, like millennials are like a generational thing, so they fit in some kind of time frame of their birth. So I would probably try and say that.
Okay.
Maybe give some basic groundwork of what they're about. The second thing is, and I think this one's super important, is maybe dispelling some myths about millennials.
There are myths about millennials?
I think there are. I see enough things. I don't know like all the extent of whatever myths are out there, but I know I've seen things on the internet or heard things on the news. People say things about millennials or say things about the current generation is what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And I just look at it and I'm like, that's hokum. All right. It's like, it's complete hokum.
I haven't
experienced all millennials at all times and all places, but I'm pretty sure they haven't either. And from what I have experienced, the millennial generation is more complex than just some simple, like, here's what's wrong with this generation video.
Uh-huh.
So a few myths might help certain old people not want them to get off their lawn.
Cheeky millennials.
I suppose the third thing would be, there's the myths dispelled, so to speak, but are there any actual concrete things we can say about millennials at all?
Good.
Like, any sort of like, well, what are they kind of about?
Sure.
And then after that, I guess the last thing is I'd be like, well, if this is what they are-ish, because there is no pretense to being comprehensive here, all right? Like,
this is about. We're just interested. I was interested because you and I have to deal with them, and I'm curious to sort of, maybe some of our audience is curious about how we find them as we go about interacting with them. But that certainly isn't comprehensive.
No, not at all. But just our thoughts on what they are technically, what myths are out there, what concrete things we could say about them. And then the fourth thing would be, how would you minister to them, whether it's educationally or relationally or in your church or whatever. Okay. There were some articles we read there that were like firing my thoughts on this recently. There was, I think, one by the Gospel Coalition, but don't quote me on that. The Gospel Coalition had like an article on how to minister to millennials. Oh. I try to talk about them. And then on the American conservative, Rod Dreher?
Rod Dreher.
He had an interview with Hans Boersma.
Oh,
yeah. Who's written like Sacramental Ontology and a couple other books.
I met him. Yeah, I was in a colloquium with him once.
Very smart guy.
Very smart.
He had an interview about his sacramental vision of the world, and he talked about millennials in there as well.
Yeah.
So those are the things kind of informing things. So
very good.
You will pick my brain and also comment along
because one
of the first things I would say is that it's not purely millennials that know who they are. They need the other generations
to give them a little
focus like, or sight on who they are as well.
Contrast, perspective.
When you're too close to something, you can't see it. You know, like the house you're standing in, kind of thing.
Right.
So, I definitely am glad you're here.
At the same time, I'm not interested in being sort of anthropological about it. You know, I mean, we're look over there in their natural habitat.
The North American millennial.
Exactly. Yeah. In a herd.
Enjoying their artisan coffee and whey.
Yes.
Or
yes,
something like
right.
that.
That's right.
No, I understand.
Yeah, because they're just human beings like we are. We're all human beings here. But there may be some experiences that they have had or problems they've had to go through, that age group has had to go through that the others haven't, or the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't had to go through some things that others have. I don't know. That might be useful to see.
Sure.
But in the end, of course, we're talking about human beings made in the image of God and deserve dignity and, you know, all that.
So with the technical definition, I guess we'll start there with point one.
Right. When you think about a millennial, do you have a kind of time frame in mind?
Yeah, most people have a literal time frame in mind. When I look around and try and figure out, like, what are the dates, the aggregate, I guess, sort of average I find is that most people say millennials are people who are born roughly between 1980 and the year 2000.
Okay.
I say roughly because it's like give or take a few years on either side of those. That doesn't seem to tell you much, all right? And there's always feels like there's exceptions. Like somebody born in 1977 feels very millennialish
for
some reason.
Uh-huh.
So what I say about it kind of corresponds to that date, those datings, but gives a bit more meat to those bones.
Yeah. Okay.
What I like to say is, if your earliest sort of cultural memory or sort of cultural memory that you have has to do in some way, shape, or form with what's called like the technological revolution, which was like the explosion of like computer and digital technology that started like in the 90s and has gone on through social media all the way to today. If your earliest kind of cultural memories is that stuff, you're probably a millennial. All right. If your earliest sort of sociocultural memory is that there was always a computer in the house and had games on it, or there was always a game console, even if it was like, you know, an Atari or something like that, that your dad got refurbished from somewhere, you're probably a millennial. If your earliest cultural memory is like the Reagan presidency in some way, even if you just picked it up sort of secondhand from your parents, like you're 10 or 11, and it's 1985, and your parents are talking about Reagan and this stuff, or you see Reagan on TV giving a speech, or you remember something about the Cold War, like your parents talking about like the Soviets in 1986, or something like that. If that's your earliest kind of cultural memory, you're probably not a millennial, all right? You're probably... Millennials, for them, even if they were born in 1989, the very day after the wall fell,
for
them... Reagan, Cold War, all that, that's history.
That's right.
That's in the history
books.
That's
right. Well, you mentioned two things. You mentioned the technology aspect of it, and that's certainly very influential on a generation. But also the fact that the wall fell in 1989, the fall of the Soviet Union, is a signpost that's massive. So if you grew up before that time, if you were conscious of a Soviet Union... maybe you're not a millennial.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Because, like, after the wall fell, an entire way the world had been for, like, 50 years or so just collapsed. It was like, in many ways, gone.
I remember talking to people back in the 60s and 70s when I was a child and hearing the fears about the possible nuclear annihilation, in the 50s people were already digging bomb shelters and so on, so the concern was even just then after the Second World War, but also in up until the fall of the Soviet Union there was always this tension between the two superpowers, and it made for a different world. It really did. It's and literally the map is different now because of the fall of the Soviet Union. So I can imagine that that growing up without any fear of nuclear, I guess it's still sort of in the background.
Well, it was in the background.
But like with Kim Jong-un now instead of people like...
And even then, like recently, we may be seeing something like this slow advent of what the next generation is going to go through, because Russia seems to be a bit more aggressive. Kim Jong-un is doing his own thing. If the protests and stuff happening in Iran don't accomplish much, that might be something. I mean, we may be stepping back into a super tense time.
But could be. It could be. The bigger threat maybe in the life of the millennials is this whole terrorist thing.
Is that fair? I was actually about to say that. Millennials are those who... their consciousness really came, their most conscious memories and sort of conscious awareness is definitely within like the technological era.
Right.
So 90s, early 2000s, that's when they kind of really developed.
Sure.
But 9/11, for me, demarcates the difference between an older millennial and a younger millennial.
Gotcha.
Okay, I say I'm an older millennial and there are younger millennials. An older millennial is kind of the same thing, all right? An older millennial is someone for whom... they remember life before 9/11, and 9/11 is a very vivid memory for them.
Sure.
A younger millennial is someone for whom, even if they were born like 2 or 3 years before 9/11...
Yeah, you're not really aware yet.
You're not really aware. You're aware. So like 9/11 is historical.
Sure.
All right? If you can... So again, if you can remember, you know, where you were, what you were doing when you heard the news about the towers, I would say that makes you an older millennial.
Uh-huh.
If you can't, if that's not a cognizant thing for you, and it's just something that in recent years you've seen in documentaries and history books, so then you're a younger millennial.
Gotcha.
What significant difference does that make? It's probably, something's probably there. Something. Exactly what? I'm not entirely sure. I know that older millennials actually have, I mean, younger millennials sign up for the military, okay? That doesn't stop. But older millennials actually have, so to speak, their war. All right. Just like our grandparents had World War II and maybe some or the Korean War. Uh-huh. And some of our parents may have had Vietnam and stuff like that, or the Gulf War.
Sure.
The first Gulf War.
Right. 93.
So our generation, the older millennials, have their war. Uh-huh. All right. Which is the War on Terror.
And it happened in the next few years after the Iraq War in 2003 and so on.
I think that does make some sort of significant distinction between an older millennial and a younger. I'm not quite sure what it is because it's probably not ubiquitous. Uh-huh. It may mean that terrorism is a very, like, for younger millennials, terrorism is just a thing that's there. For older millennials, terrorism holds a deeper significance and substance to it because we saw what happened, and that may shape our kind of political view and outlook or something like that. But I'm not entirely sure the exact implications of it. I just know that to be a millennial means your conscious awareness is not of the Soviet Union and stuff. It's after that. It's mainly technological revolution stuff. And if you're an older millennial, you're cognizantly aware of September 11th. It was a thing. You were there. You saw
Makes perfect sense. Okay, so are we saying that before the millennials, before the older millennials, we have a kind of a Generation X? Is that what they call them?
Yeah.
And then before that would be the baby boomers?
Suppose. In the broad swath of things, there may be in Gen Xers distinctions like older and younger. I'm not sure what would mark it, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were. That's part of the complexity of any given generation, is that even within it, though they have kind of a shared sort of cultural consciousness about things, there are still things that demarcate them as different, even from each other. But yeah, if you want to, the big, broad brushstrokes are millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers.
Gotcha.
Yeah, going backward. Not going forward.
Right, I gotcha. Yeah, okay, I guess that makes me a baby boomer. and because I was born in 57, and Gen Xers were started maybe in what, the 70s somewhere?
60s, 70s, somewhere in there.
Okay. I can see a demarcation between those two, the 60s in particular. But let's go back to the talk about the millennials themselves. So the word millennial actually has to do not so much with being born in 2000, but sort of coming of age in the technological world that is the new generation, new century.
Basically. So that's how I think of it, because it seems pretty consistent. I'm sure there's probably minor exceptions to the rule or something like that, but it seems to be pretty consistent. This is something all millennials kind of share in common.
Okay.
Even between older and younger ones.
Well, what are some of the myths then about millennials? What do we believe that maybe isn't?
Well, let me start by
saying... unicorn-ish.
Yes. About them. Let me start by saying, I guess, a couple preliminary things to it. First of all, again, not comprehensive. I have no idea how many myths are out there, how many individual myths people believe about things. There's probably just a few on my own mind that I've seen. Second of all, I'm not saying necessarily everybody believes them, but these things I'm about to mention are things I've seen that just seem to be out there in some way, all right?
Okay.
And third, if you happen to believe one of these myths, it does not make you a bad person.
Okay,
let me just say that. So. Okay. Some of them may be extra silly and be easy to just kind of dismiss. Others, maybe not so much. But those of us in the millennial generation who are cognizant of the fact that we are in the millennial generation are the ones who get most frustrated by this, partially because we know there are examples within our generation that can serve as examples to somehow bolster those myths.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Because it's
generalities.
Like, right, generalities that don't come from nowhere, if I can say, right? They are somewhere, but just like any stereotype or caricature, it's not really the whole truth.
Sure.
It's just sort of an aggregate truth.
We used to say that generalities were only good 51% of the time.
That's a good way of putting it.
So that's kind of how it is.
So I suppose one of the first ones that I've heard, I don't know if you've heard this, but one of the first ones is that that millennials are lazy. That
yes.
They're like the
That's what I've heard. That
they're the laziest, a very lazy generation. They have no work ethic. They have no sense of like, a job well done. They want everything done for them, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's not true. Okay, I can speak directly to that experientially in all other ways. That is completely false.
Yeah.
Are there lazy millennials out there? I'm sure. Are there lazy Gen Xers and baby boomers? Yes. Okay, laziness is a common human vice. It's not unique.
I was going to say sloth is one of the big seven, isn't
right,
it?
Right. It's a common thing.
Yeah. We've been talking about that for centuries.
I think the argument wants to be that another thing that marks the millennials as a generation is because they grew up in the technological revolution and because they grew up basically post-Cold War,
yep.
They grew up in what can be described as a decadent time.
Uh-huh.
Now, when I mean decadent, I don't mean everybody's rich, because that's clearly not true. We have all the goods and services we'll ever want or need, because that's not true either. What I mean is that there are tons of options and conveniences and comforts out there that have been supplied by technology. In the 90s, the relative peace that came after the Cold War was over, tensions
certainly
were released.
Did.
So there was definitely, and even after 9/11, which caused like fear and trepidation, technology continued to pace.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. And so we have grown up with a lot more creature comforts and conveniences and stuff. I mean, for goodness sake, try and imagine like maybe back in like the 70s or 80s, trying to plan like a family vacation, all the things you'd have to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have this little, black rectangular box called my phone where I can on that same thing find a place, look up the best parts about it, make a list, and copy and paste that list to my photos so I have a list of all the things to do, then get on Airbnb, find a place, register a place, pay for it, and be done in like 20 minutes.
Right.
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 And then I don't even
have to make a phone call.
Don't even have to make a phone call, right? They have a messaging service where you can quickly message. And then I have my own car,
right?
Because cars are super ubiquitous, and even a somewhat older one will still be okay. And I can drive there myself.
Sure.
That is an incredible amount of creature comfort.
And power and information right at your fingertips.
I can understand why people would look at that. They'd see that fact. And then they look and they'd see lazy millennials. They'd see some. And right. They'd put two and two together and say, well, millennials are just a completely lazy generation because they have everything handed to them. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's false. Okay? It's not true at all. Baby boomers, I know from my own experience, I mean, from my own sort of anecdotal experience, I know it's false. I'm working two jobs and trying to get a PhD and trying to be married all at the same time. Right. One of my close friends is married, two kids. She's working, he's working, and going to school to try and pursue like the calling upon him. One of his best friends was a teacher who, when he's not teaching, he like is out in the woods being a woodsman, and he's building like, you know, craft stuff in his own wood shop. You know, one day one of the first times I met him, I went out to his house for like just a get together, and he was like slaughtering a hog like all by himself that he had shot on his own property, and he was like preparing the bacon and the ribs and stuff like that. No qualms with getting dirty, no qualms with doing work. Most millennials hold down multiple jobs because a lot of millennials have a very clear idea of like what they want to do, and they have the option to do it because of all those convenience. There is a way forward. And so many of them hold down multiple jobs and pursue their thing as a hobby. All right. Mm-hmm. There are millennials who, by their business savvy and winsomeness, have turned internet videos into like $1 million things.
Sure.
There's been entrepreneurs. Sure. It's just not true that they're lazy. Okay.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg is himself a millennial, isn't he?
Yeah, technically. Probably. Yeah, he's a millennial. All right. Yeah. And he became a billionaire overnight.
Must have had to work somehow.
So the sense that they're lazy or that they're inclined towards laziness, I don't think is true. Especially so because of the economic recession that happened, like in 2008, things collapsed and stuff.
Yes.
In 2008, a lot of us, myself included, were graduating from college or had graduated from college, and we were stepping into the workforce. And the old notion of go to college, get your degree, get out, get a job, just completely collapsed. There was no such thing as like go out and find a job. So a lot of millennials stepped out there. Yes, there were millennials who, as Ben Shapiro would put it, you know, got their degree in lesbian dance theory. And so maybe their job market was already narrow, even in the best of circumstances. But I'm pretty sure there are plenty of millennials who got, like, you know, education degrees or, you know, nursing degrees or doctor degrees or business degrees, all kinds of stuff. Sure. And there was nothing out there, or it had dried up.
Yeah,
and they had to scrap together and do what they can.
One of the stereotypical characteristics of a millennial is that he still lives in his parents' basement. Isn't that right?
Yes.
And that sort of is connected with this idea of laziness. But it also is connected with what you just said about this downturn in the economy that made it difficult for people to sort of launch earlier in their lives, I think, don't you think? Now, whether that's true or not, it represents that kind of, sort of the outcome of that kind of idea.
I know in my own life it was true. I graduated in 2008. I was 24. That was 10 years ago. Good grief. So I was 24. I didn't leave my parents' house on my own until I was 28.
There you go.
All right. I mean, why? Because I was like, even my parents were like, stay home and save money.
Right.
Like, save money. But there's no reason for you to suddenly put a rental thing or something. And even when I did move out, I moved out with my brother and a roommate, and we split a place.
Yeah.
And I split a place for years. And even after I got away from my roommates, is because I got married. So I'm technically still splitting a place. So
yes,
I can never say I've ever accomplished the kind of rugged individual shoot out on my own, go live in like a studio apartment living on scraps, but I'm making it.
I can't
say that because I was like, first of all, that feels stupid to me. But second of all, it's like I have a family, I have a house, I have an opportunity to save money.
Yeah.
I have a goal. Why not? So, yeah, either some of us who did live with our parents a bit longer, but it was because the economy went down and we were trying to save money and find a way to do jobs and trying to do it smart.
I didn't mean anything by it.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't pointing the fingers at you.
I
would never do that. No, but I'm just saying that sounds like a stereotypical kind of characteristic. And it's an extension of this idea that we think that the millennial is lazy. But I'm with you. I know plenty of college students back at Crichton, who are now just doing great things. They've entrepreneurs, many of them on their own, and have worked their tails off to get there. So that whole idea is a little silly.
So that's the first one, I guess, that they're lazy. They're not. There are lazy ones, but
of course,
my experience has not been they're lazy. Even our students now, who are definitely younger millennials, I would not call them lazy.
No.
Right? Not even.
No.
The students I work with at the University of Memphis, 18, 19-year-olds, young millennials, they want to go open their own nursing practices. They want to get a business degree so they can start their own business. They want to be engineers so they can build things and get they're all very, very, maybe it's a Memphis thing, maybe it's a Southern thing, kind of blue collar, grit and grind type of thing. But there is this sense of, I'm here to get a degree so I can get a job so I can work.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, right? So the lazy thing is just a myth. A second myth that's somewhat connected to it is the notion that millennials are entitled.
Uh-huh.
I see videos about this. There's actually a video that keeps going around. I think it's like two British guys, I think, and one of them looks very, you know, has like a white sweater on, and he speaks very like, the problem with this generation and stuff like that. And it's basically the idea, this is basically the summary of like the whole myth,
okay.
that
oh,
because
yeah.
we're the generation that grew up on participation trophies
oh,
and everyone's
right.
a winner
sure.
and self-esteem and the Disney idea of like, you know, believe in yourself and you can accomplish whatever.
Sure.
Because
sure.
we grew up on that, we've now all turned into snowflakes who scream on, you know, campuses for safe spaces and stuff like that.
Right,
it's
right.
connected to the lazy thing in that it's similar to like, we don't want to deal with the hardships of existence mm-hmm. or something like that. We mm-hmm. think like...
Hear anybody say anything that could offend us.
Right. Like we could, the things ought to be easy for us. You know,
right.
we are entitled to easiness. All right.
Yeah, yeah.
That is false.
That's false.
That's not true. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are loud, screamy young kids on campuses that make this look very, very true. All right. Part of that is the internet. And I'll get to that in a second in my third myth.
Okay.
But part of that is the internet, which loves spectacle and loves to really
true.
Emphasize those things and like
true.
Point those things out and make it look like it's bigger than it is. But I'm pretty sure I've also seen some like Gen Xers and baby boomers on those campuses too, encouraging them to yell and shout,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
The entitlement attitude is not exclusive to the millennials. There is a deep philosophical and political apparatus going on that makes them feel like certain things ought to be the way they should be. And that philosophical and political apparatus has been going on for like 30, 40 years. So they're just
yeah.
the inheritors of a thing that's not unique to them.
I think you've got a point there. It's an additional variable in our equation about what a millennial is, that that many of them are on the political left.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of mindset in the political left sometimes that encourages campus unrest, snowflake activity, and so on. I mean, you certainly saw plenty of campus unrest in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
It's not a new idea, fighting against wars, but then also fighting against, for feminism or for
Marxism.
Marxism, yeah. exactly. Lots of different things. But it's that additional element of a political mindset
right.
that might lead you toward the snowflake.
Yeah, the snowflakes you see are just the inheritors of the campus radicals from the 60s and
70s. Because they do exist.
They do exist.
I mean, you do see
right?
them on, right now. So if you wanted to, what you're saying is that you'd misapply the idea of snowflake.
Yeah.
If you do it to the whole of the generation.
Millennials have their snowflakes just like baby boomers have their campus whatever's,
you well know, said.
So, I think so,
that's
so
fair.
Forth.
Sure.
I think, like I said, I believe the internet, with its love of spectacle and its love of kind of like aggregating all
uh-huh.
those common things together into a big lump, makes it look like that's all of them, or that's
yeah.
like a giant case. But that's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like because the alt-right for a while aggregated a lot of stuff in the internet and claimed and that must mean everybody on the right is alt-right
sure.
or something like that.
Sure, that's
it's a similar
right.
sort of mistake. I
sure.
will say this, millennials. All humans, there's always been dreamers, all right? People who have like kind of lofty, sort of starry-eyed ambitions about things.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say millennials are definitely dreamers, maybe even more so than previous generations.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think that may have something to do with the follow your dreams thing, but also to do with like the technological, they have the opportunity. I mean, forget, like I said, for goodness sake, there were people who all they had was their computer and a camera and some silly idea, and it caught fire on the internet, and now they have they've made enough money to have an entire studio and crew to like keep going. I mean,
yeah, right.
You can do that, and you don't need like a degree. You don't need to network. You don't
That's
need
good
to know
point.
People.
That's
so
right.
we have the ability to actually, so to speak, fulfill our dreams if we follow it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to
mm-hmm.
say that most millennials understand that in order to do it, you have to do it. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's not just going to fall in your lap. But yeah, there is the dreamer and the dreamer sort of idea, and the technology that helps it may create an illusion of like a sense of entitlement. Millennials really think that they can fulfill their whatever,
mm-hmm.
right? There's an idealism there. I'll admit
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see entitlement because I do connect it to the laziness thing, and that I think millennials do understand the hardships of life because of 9/11, because of the financial collapse, because
mm-hmm.
they have to work two or three jobs while trying to pursue the thing that they're actually trying to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
I do think they get it, all
okay.
right? And that they're not all the loud, snowflakey type of thing.
Yeah, okay.
The third thing that's connected somewhat to the second one is that millennials regularly can't distinguish fantasy from reality.
Hmm.
This one I've heard before. Basically, it goes like this. Because they're the generation that grew up on video games and just able to watch, you know, home movies, you know, that was in the 80s too, but it really explodes into, like, you know, the 90s and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet and internet stuff, screens constantly.
Mm-hmm.
They live in a fantasy world, you know, a mm-hmm. Facebook world where, you know, your profile thing is what's real. Or video games where, you know, that world is what's real, something like that. Mm-hmm. A massive multiplayer online RPG like World of Warcraft or something like that, where you get lost in or something like that.
Yeah.
So millennials can't distinguish fantasy from reality, which is part of why they're entitled, because they think that things ought to be easy when they're not.
Uh-huh.
That is false. All right. Millennials, and this one I almost want to, like, really, really emphasize how false that is.
Okay.
There are certainly people who video games, for example, have become like a reality to them that's bigger than their real life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But even people in the video gaming community, so to speak, recognize those people as problems. Right? That's bad. That's not good.
It's almost an addiction.
It's almost like an addiction. It's no different than any other addiction to something, sure. whether it be a drug or isolation or mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there are examples like that, but millennials are not the generation who can't distinguish fantasy from reality. In my experience, both of my friends, my own life, and the stuff I've read and seen, not only is that not true, it's almost completely, flatly the opposite.
Wow.
Millennials want reality. I think it's been a weird... I even noticed this back in my 20s when, like, Facebook was really getting big. This was a big concern, that Facebook makes people not have real community. I saw the complete opposite.
Uh-huh.
I saw that people would get on Facebook, do this thing, and they would be like, this is cool, but these aren't real people. This is not my friends. It actually created this weird starvation for real contact with people.
Interesting.
People actually wanted to, you know, they would use Facebook to create a time and place where we could go meet,
uh-huh.
right? And go actually be face to face with people.
Huh.
The millennial generation is the generation that wants to have, that clamors for real community.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them buy into a post-structuralist idea that kind of undermines that, but that's another discussion. But they want real, like, concrete community. They're the generation that loves artisan stuff, not mm-hmm. manufacturer stuff. They want something that's handcrafted.
Certainly see that a lot.
They're the generation, I would argue, saved books from e-readers and Kindles and stuff like that. There was an article that came out either last year or the year before saying that books are actually... have made a comeback, that e-readers and stuff have leveled out and book sales continue to rise. And
it's that way with recordings too, isn't it? They don't want the digital ones. They want to go back to the old...
they want a vinyl.
They want
the digital stuff, but they want the vinyl as well. They feel like there's something more real, more... The word that often gets thrown around is authentic.
Authentic.
Right? Mm. The millennial generation, and this is something we're kind of bleeding into, what can we concretely say about it, but that's okay.
That's right.
The millennial generation... wants concrete things. This is something Hans Morsma said that I completely agree with. They want real, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They want things that feel more substantive.
Mm-hmm.
Even within their digital mediums. I remember maybe 10 years ago when the big kind of thing that was happening in video games was, while all the big what's called AAA developers, like these massive multi-million dollar EA or whatever developers, something like that, making these huge games with, like, the best graphics and the latest voice actors and all the jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was going on. There was an explosion of what was known as indie games or independent games.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them throwbacks to the 80s.
Huh.
Like video games that look like they came off of the Nintendo from, like, you know, 1980 or something like that. Even from the look of them, from the way they were structured to the music that they had. They all were throwbacks.
Was it some sort of nostalgia?
I think there is bound up in that a kind of nostalgia. All
this
right?
is what I first played on when I was 8 or something?
There is that, and also a sense that it's weird. The millennial generation grew up in this technological, digital everything.
Right.
And because of that, the myth is that they just are obsessed with fantasy rather than reality. No,
mm-hmm.
I say it's completely opposite. Because they grew up with that, they are acutely aware of what's false and what's real.
Huh.
And they want what's real.
Uh-huh.
And so they'll look at a AAA game that's big and money and stuff, but when they play it, it's really just kind of a basic game. You know, there's a lot of flash to it, but
uh-huh.
the game itself, I played the same thing a million times. But those old games where you couldn't rely on graphics and stuff to make it flashy, you had to really build a good, interesting game.
Uh-huh.
That feels substantive. You know?
Interesting.
You know, something like the one, it's not the first one, and if I say this, gamers will probably unite in arms with torches and pitchforks to get at me. But I feel like one of the early ones that did this was a game called Braid, which kind of I don't know if it kicked the door open or whatever, but it was a significant moment because it was one of the earliest sort of indie games, and it looked good. It didn't look like it was something from like a Nintendo, but it was built the same way. It was like an old school platformer that emphasized puzzles, and it wasn't trying to look super realistic. It was had like this artsy type of thing, and it relied more on storytelling and narrative, and so, and it blew people's minds. And more games like that came because it felt like it was something. This has got substance to it. You know, this is not just a bunch of mindless flash. Call of Duty is super fun. I actually, I'll play like all Modern Warfare games multiple times, but I do it just to like air out and relax. It's not anything that requires any neurons to fire in your brain whatsoever, basically. So it's just all flash and all fun. These games are substantive. And so there's a sense of like substance.
Is it because it has a story to it?
Is it that part?
Is it narrative?
I feel like it could be a whole discussion of why. It's just
maybe
there's
we
something
do
about
one
it.
On video games sometimes.
There's something about it. I would love to do that. I would love to bring in someone to like even be a part of that conversation. Mm-hmm. But it's all I can say is that there's something about it that feels more substantive. Maybe the same way that like a mass-produced chair doesn't feel as substantive. Like something you buy at Walmart and assemble for like a desk you buy at Walmart and you assemble with like the cork wood or the plywood or whatever.
Right.
Doesn't feel as substantive as if you bought a chair that was built by an artisan and it's an antique store or something like that.
Absolutely.
How is it more substantive? Maybe you can't put your finger on it, but you know it is.
Well, it's got real wood, say, and it's got handcrafted aspects to it.
I think it's the craft.
Instead of machine.
I think
crafted.
It is the craftsmanship idea that there feels like there was actual effort and energy put into it.
Significance of that individual piece rather than the mass production. So that makes sense.
So this myth I really wanted to like park on for a bit second more, because if those of you out there who are the Gen Xers, baby boomers or beyond who want to be, you know, get off my lawn or whatever, the millennials, we can forgive you maybe for the entitlement of lazy one because we're too busy working to really pay attention to that. But this one, if you get this one wrong, you're never going to understand millennials.
Uh-huh.
Right? If you get this one flipped on your head, never going to understand them. They want reality.
Yeah.
They may go to the wrong places.
Sure.
And fall into fantasy, or they may fall into a lie, but they want what's real. They want substance. They want something that has some meat on it, you know? The same thing that animates, you know, their desire for our, like, artesian breads over, you know, manufactured breads is the same thing that may drive them out of their big mainline prosperity gospel contemporary worship church into Catholicism.
Uh-huh.
You know, like a high church type thing, because it feels like there's more to it.
Yeah.
So they are definitely not the generation of fantasy over reality. They're surrounded by a lot of fantasy, but that makes them starved and hungry for reality. So they want it really bad. Even I feel that.
Well said.
Like I feel that in my own bones in a way.
Mm-hmm.
The only other myth I'll talk about real quick is the fourth one. And the fourth one is not connected to the others. But the fourth, okay, so the first myth is they're lazy. That's not true. The second myth is they're entitled. Also false. The third myth that they're obsessed with fantasy or reality. Also false. Completely false. Utterly false. The fourth one is that they're going to save the world. All right? This is the other side of the equation. Because of like the negative myths that rise up and get promulgated over and over and over again, some of them by people with British accents that sound really authoritative. I hope people know what video I'm talking about. It drives me nuts. People keep wanting to throw it around. This is what's wrong with this generation. No. Okay, no.
They got it wrong.
But they got it wrong.
Okay.
But the fourth myth is like, because all of those negative ones, a positive myth comes up, mainly that, millennials, you know, because of their technological savvy and they're the most literate generation in ever, you know, without considering like, well, they know how to read, but what are they reading?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, like they're the most literate and they're the most active and the most ideal, you know, they're the ones who like all their hopes can be pinned on, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. Okay. That's also completely false because millennials are still human beings. They're still sinners. They're not saviors.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own genuine foibles and flaws, which we can get into. They have their own genuine limitations that are unique to them and others that are just common to all human beings, mainly the issue of sin. If you have been feeling inclined out there because you hear all the negative ones, you get mad and you want to constantly defend millennials, do not fall into the trap of the positive myth that somehow the millennials are the generation we've been waiting. Like, what was it? What was it? Obama said, we are the ones we've been waiting for or something like that.
Yes, right.
Do not fall into that trap.
Okay.
Do not fall into that trap. That's the fourth myth, I guess I would say.
Is that something that millennials themselves actually do think and are mistaken about? Or is it you're correcting them as well as those who are outside the myth?
I'm going to say right now that
generation?
This correction is for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Whether or not millennials as a whole buy into their like a savior complex,
uh-huh.
I don't think so. I know there's probably, you know, I remember vividly there was the guys who did like, oh, what did they do? They like did like lost children or disappearing children. There were guys who went to Africa and like focused on like child soldiers and stuff like that. Under a guy named Joseph Kony, I think, was like the warlord or whatever, right, was using them.
Right.
And I remember in 2012, they were did this viral thing called Kony 2012, which was on the specific date, on the specific moment, they wanted everyone across the world to make Joseph Kony famous by like plastering all these posters and bumper stickers and stickers and stuff and Facebook and posts and stuff all over social media all about Kony 2012. In order to create this global awareness about this dude who was using the child soldiers.
I see.
And, gosh, I can't remember. I want to say it was Uganda, but I could be wrong. Right, what nation it was. I don't think that's correct.
I forget.
But whatever nation, African nation he was in.
Right.
Right. Right. All right. So the big deal. And I remember the video. All right. They released a video on the internet because that's what you do in 2012. And, oh, it was such an incredible use of emotional propaganda. It just was. It was like the pathetic fallacy all over the place. It used emotions, it used like sweeping music, it used simplification of ideas. The main guy like had his little like 3-year-old son on there trying to talk about like who's Kony and child soldiers and how it makes him sad and stuff like that. And here's the thing though, it was all done, this was the other thing, it was all done sincerely. Like these guys weren't trying to manipulate. They really thought, we're going to make this dude famous and we're going to make a positive change in the world if we do this thing. And it was so powerful that my brother and I were watching it and we were moved. And my brother actually ordered like the Kony 2012 kit, all right, to come. And it gave you like a t-shirt to wear and a poster to put up somewhere and a sticker somewhere. I think we may still have the sticker on our mini fridge somewhere because we didn't know what else to do with it. But there was this sense of like, there was this sense. I remember looking at it and feeling very moved, even myself. But after I got away from it, I looked at it, it was like there was this strong sense of, because we have YouTube and Twitter and Facebook, because we have those things, we can create a kind of connectivity that no one else has had. And through that connectivity, we can create a change on a global scale that no one else can do. It's almost like we can save the world like no one else can. Now, the end of this whole Kony 2012 thing was not at all what they were expecting or what anybody hoped for. It all kind of petered out, mainly because Joseph Kony had already been gone and people were like, the nation that they were supposedly trying to help was actually getting frustrated with this group of people constantly bringing attention to the issue because they're like, look, we already kicked out Kony. Yeah. The child soldiers are rescued. We're building our country back together. Stop making us look like a bunch of backwards, in trouble.
I see.
So it actually, the bubble got kind of popped kind of thing. But there is this kind of, we can save the world. I feel like the thing that was animating Kony 2012 was animating Occupy Wall Street. Right, I feel like it was animating that. This is the thing that's going to change the world.
Right.
I sometimes feel like it animates Anonymous in some ways. That group, like, we could. There was a documentary about Anonymous who, by the end of it, it basically had that attitude that somehow this was written before Occupy Wall Street fell apart, but like it was like Anonymous and its activism thing and getting on board with these big ideals and helping with the Arab Spring was going to make the Arab Spring this beautiful thing and Occupy Wall Street was going to be this beautiful thing, right? Then like a couple years after the documentary, Arab Spring turned into all the chaos and civil wars that we have, the rise of ISIS, Occupy Wall Street fell apart.
Right.
I mean, it was ugly. I feel like so you say, is it for millennials, that cautious for millennials as well as everyone else? It is for everyone else, whether millennials are still bought up in that we can save the world idea or if they become a little jaded.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But I will say that this is a warning for everyone. Don't fall into any of these myths, including the one that says millennials are somehow special and can save the world. We're not. Okay. We can't save the world.
You know, I'm thinking about the 60s. There was a watershed in the 60s called Woodstock, you may remember.
Yes.
In your history books. back when dinosaurs ruled the world. But it was the same pattern in a way. There was this kind of optimism about we can change the world. We can set things right. We can create a new age of... Well, of Aquarius, they called it, right? That it was going to be an age of love and peace and all that. And at Woodstock, to a degree, it, I think, happened. I mean, there was everybody got along fairly well. There wasn't any conflict and so on. Well, the very next year, there was this new second, what was going to be a Woodstock kind of place, at this Rolling Stones concert in California. And it was, what was the name of the, Altamont Speedway. That's what it was. It was at one of these racetracks. And the Rolling Stones were going to play. And everybody was coming from all over the country, you know, to hear this concert, this big concert. And it would be another sort of event of love and peace and all that. And the Rolling Stones hired the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang to be their bodyguards.
All right.
And they actually killed a couple of people.
Oh.
The crowd got rowdy or whatever, and somebody tried to run on stage or didn't do what the Hell's Angels thought they ought to do, and they got beaten up, and somebody else died. I mean, it was just horrible.
Right.
And it was like that big picture, that beautiful rainbow unicorn picture of love and peace and so on, was popped. And from that point on, I think the 70s was a kind of reaction against all that, a kind of cynical sadness that settled on everybody. And it was even that way a little bit with drugs, that, you know, they actually argued in the early 60s that drugs were actually a good thing for us, that we opened our minds and expand our consciousness. Timothy Leary talked about how it would be a good thing if we put LSD in the water supply.
Yeah.
This would be good for everybody. You see, it was a kind of, it was mind-bogglingly stupid, but it was optimistic is what I'm trying to get at, you know? And then at the end of that, suddenly, you have this Altamont Speedway and the bubble bursts, and the 70s continued to use drugs, but it was now escapism. It wasn't the same thing. It wasn't the same philosophy anymore. It wasn't like we were opening our minds to some great new thing. Yeah. My generation did. I think that pattern is not an unusual human pattern, where you get this idea that everything's going to be perfect. We can save the world. We can set things right. And optimistically, and young people are prone to optimism that way, and
they
that's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing.
Inherently.
I think this is a perfect way to transition into, like, what are some concrete things we can say?
Yeah. What can we talk about, millennials?
Aside from the millennials are obsessed with authenticity and reality. They want real substantive things, probably because the decadence that they're surrounded by, the digital decadence even, doesn't offer them anything like that. There is a kind of, I don't know if I want to call it cynicism or jadedness or something, it could turn into that, but there is some kind of, especially with older millennials who like saw 9/11 and like felt all patriotic for the most part, probably like everyone else did, but then saw the war on terror turn into kind of a quagmire and it just seems to drag on forever and there's no finish line like our grandparents had, you know, like defeat Hitler, right? Well, we killed Osama bin Laden, why are we still fighting the war on terror?
Right,
like,
when
it just keeps going on. Kony 2012 bust, Obama was supposed to be, you know, this great, he got elected and there was like video footage of millennial age people, my people just running into the streets chanting, yes, we can, and triumph and some of that. 8 years later, he's just another politician with scandal and stuff behind his Obamacare was a bust, Benghazi scandals, the Fast and the Furious scandals.
That's right.
IRS scandals.
Corruption
targeting
and all sorts corruption, of parts of the government.
It's just another failure. The recent election in 2016 has probably even further jaded them on the idea of like elections or something like that. There is a kind of innate distrust of things that, like, you know, established politics, institutional religion. Right?
Sure.
We talked about that a couple times ago.
Because
there's an assumption that there's some kind of fakeness in it somewhere, you know. Millennials, and this is where like the whole desire for reality thing is neither ultimately good or bad because it can go either way, right? Your desire for reality can lead you to the truth. Your desire for reality can also lead you not only into error, but like you dig down into it if you really think this is where substance is. If you think Marxism is the answer, well, man,
you embrace it.
You're going to embrace it and go on campuses and.
Right.
As Jordan Peterson said, you'll put paper on sticks and shake it at people and call them names. Basically, I mean, you will do it. You will do it. What you're seeing in even the snowflakey generation is people who want reality, who have embraced a lie that they think is reality, and they are sticking to it, man. There is a zeal in millennials for the real, the zeal for the real, I guess I could call
that's
it that.
That's nice. That sounds like a bumper sticker.
And that is I demand a quarter every time somebody says it. That is probably defining the millennials in a big way. And like I said, that can go right or wrong. Yes. All right. I think the snowflakes are a perfect example of how it goes terribly wrong.
Well, a real desire for authenticity can go one way or the other, like you say.
Right.
That's true. I like the way you're thinking, because it's not the there's nothing wrong inherently with wanting authenticity. It's just a question of what you attach yourself to.
Right. So there's the desire for the real. There's a zeal for it. There is a kind of is a weird tension of like idealism and cynicism. Some people have called this the they've tried to call it the metamodern situation. Like they're trying to say, well, we're beyond postmodern, we're metamodern. I don't know if that's true or not, but Shia LaBeouf is very metamodernist. Okay, and I'm not even joking. Like this is a thing he's on. If you want, go onto the internet and Google the metamodernist manifesto, I think, or something like that.
Oh my goodness, there's a manifesto now.
It's very simple and short, and it's basically the idea is that to be in a metamodernist situation is to oscillate back and forth between a kind of cynicism that just kind of, you know, doubts everything, you know, and just takes nothing seriously, you know, a kind of nothing is sacred, whatever, a cynicism and an idealism that wants something real, you know, that wants something real. You're kind of oscillating back and forth.
I see.
I think that, I'm not sure if I want to call it metamodern or all that jazz, but this idea of oscillation, I feel like does mark the millennial generation. There is this weird kind of, they can be very cynical, all right, about politicians. We're going to say, I feel it. Like, I'm super, I feel like a lot of ways I'm super cynical about, like, politics right now or something like that. Maybe more so than my parents' generation was. You know, does my vote really count? I'm not sure anymore. Or something like that. Or like, are these parties we have? Do we really have to go with either one of them? I'm not sure anymore. Some stuff like that, right? Sure. There's a deep cynicism about those things. And yet there is, at the same time, this deep desire for, like, a real statesman or something like that. Or a real piece of legislation that sets things right or something like that. You know, there's still this ideal of, like, a president who would actually be a good leader or something like that. So it's I understand that. I think that that oscillation. So it's like they desire reality, all right? They desire authenticity and substance is one thing we can say about them. And they have a zeal for it that can be dangerous.
Yeah.
But the second thing I could probably say about them is this oscillation, all right? There's a reason they like something like Rick and Morty, and yet there's also a reason why if Rick and Morty, I'm going to speculate that if Rick and Morty ends on like ends on a really sad or bad ending, it won't set well. Like it'll leave kind of a bad taste in their mouth in some way. In some way, they might not want to admit it, but I want to speculate and say that it probably would leave like a bad taste in our mouths.
So what you're saying is they don't mind flirting with nihilism and meaninglessness and cynicism and that kind of thing, but in the end they want it to actually come back around to something positive.
I see this as the same tension in my own sort of scholarship when I'm dealing with like the post-structural thing. Post-structuralism, which has influenced all of culture in the West, at least, for like the last 50 years, maybe, is caught in the same conundrum. Post-structuralism is a nihilistic viewpoint, that there is meaning is simply a product of language rather than something language is trying to reveal. Thus, meaning is either doesn't, meaning in some multiple capital M ontological sense doesn't exist, or if it does exist, there's no way to reach it because our language is only used to manipulate, it can't reveal, kind of thing. All right. It's fundamentally nihilistic. And so people will take that and use that to attack institutions, attack authorities, attack the patriarchy, attack whatever. Right. But they're
that's corrosive of everything it touches.
Right, but there's the weird tension in there. They want to use it on the things they think are bad.
So where do they get the idea of the good?
Right, the good. But that's the thing. It's like, where do they get the idea of the good? But they have an idea.
Right.
And that's what
even
I mean
if
by
they can't admit
the oscillation. Oscillation. It can, and it's not always necessarily contradictory, because I don't think it's necessarily contradictory to, like, treat certain things with a kind of, cynic's not the right word, but it's kind of like a grain of salt, and still desire, you know, whatever. And as a matter of fact, your grain of salt mentality may be fueled by your desire for real.
Yeah.
But there can be also that, this is the same thing with, like, the zeal thing. The zeal for the real can go right or wrong.
Right.
Right? Same thing with this oscillation thing. It can go right or wrong. You can be oscillating because you have this sort of cynical grain of salt view of things, but that's because you really desire something real, or you can be caught in this contradiction where you somehow buy into nihilism and not at the same time. And nihilism is useful when it's making fun of things you think are fake or inauthentic, but then when it comes to stuff that was a really real thing for you, don't you dare touch it.
Well, that's the problem I think we see today. I think there's an awful lot of of corrosive attack against a lot of institutional things, maybe for some good reasons, mind you. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of that kind of attack is based in this notion that there isn't anything that's true. But as soon as you say that, you have to give up all the things that you secretly think are true. And that's not going to happen. People don't do that. So this is a human problem, but it's worked out in its unique way, I think, in the millennial generation.
I agree. So it's not the same as, like, I feel like it would be cliche to say Gen X was like the fully cynical generation, but that's kind of the cliche. It's like they're the fully cynical and we're like half cynical, half not.
Do you think that there's anything in there that we should address as we instruct in the... What we're doing, of course, is giving them a foundation in the history of Western civilization. Right. How is it that we could best get that across to them, given the kinds of things you've just described?
Well, how I would do it, and what I'm about to say, it sounds like it's going to be a plug for the center. Like, great, welcome to this commercial.
All right. I like it.
But I mean, seriously, this is what we try to do, and this is what I think we're doing, is how will we present that foundation? I feel like the first thing would be is to actually present it. All right, don't make excuses for it.
Uh-huh.
All right, show them the real actual. This is what the Greeks actually thought. This is your real foundation. This is where everything. The fact that you're showing them a foundation at all is part and part. This is the substance.
Uh-huh.
All right, and don't. So my first thing would be give them actual substance. All right, give them here's your actual foundation. And second of all, don't make any apologies for it. Don't want to try to whitewash it or spin it in some way that you think they're supposedly entitled progressivist sensibilities. But no.
Right.
Show them the foundation and all its kind of massive significance. Mm-hmm. All right?
And that speaks to their desire for authenticity.
Yeah, it is something that's real. I mean, why I feel like we've had success with having millennial students because we're offering foundational stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We can have our one student who, like, you know, he was a super snarky, internet savvy millennial who was flirting with socialism, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have him. We could put him in a state where he walks into his Notre Dame and sees the rose window and he sees something of substance, right? And that just grabs him, like, by the belt buckle and throws him to the ground, right?
Yeah.
So just giving them something foundational and giving it to them unapologetically and unashamedly is the thing. Because that's the thing. Any sort of couching of it or trying to, like, you know, mollify. This is where I think, like, especially theologically, I think we're like liberal theology, whether it be like the old stuff from like the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the 20s all the way to the emergent church in like the early 2000s.
Right.
This is where they get it wrong. All right. They think that somehow capitulating to the culture is going to make them more relevant. I would say never, but especially in the millennial generation.
Uh-huh.
If you turn your religion into just kind of, because what capitulating to the culture looks like is you basically just look like, you know, a rock concert with a cheesy pop concert with pop psychology, positive thinking.
Yes.
And guess what millennials think that is? Fake.
Yeah.
That's utterly fake.
They see through that.
They see right through it. They see right through it.
That's encouraging to me, actually.
So that, and that's the thing, I guess, because I think we're running out of time, but in regards to the ministry, like how would you minister to them or mentor to them? You have to be real, right? And I don't mean just like, well, like be like your real you, yes, all right? But I mean like believe what you believe and believe it in front of them, all right? And talk about it openly in front of them. And if they have questions, answer their daggum questions.
Sure.
Engage their questions. Don't act like, because this thing, because if you, the thing you believe, and they ask questions, and you're like, oh, no, you don't have, you know, don't talk, you don't really answer, you mealy-mally around it or something like that, or you won't admit that you don't know, that reeks to them of fakeness and insubstantiality.
Mm-hmm.
If it can't stand up to questions, or you feel like you have to shield it from critique, then it must not have much to it.
Right.
But if you're willing to engage their questions, even to the point where you say, well, you know, I'm not actually sure, that's honesty.
That's very healthy.
And that's honesty, and that's authenticity, that's real.
That's what they want. Well, I'm glad. That's actually an encouraging point, I think. And you're right. I think that's what we're doing here. I'd like to think we're trying to do that.
I also think, and this is like on a practical day-to-day level, millennials, they care about, and this is specifically for Christians, and this could be a whole other conversation, but just like to drop the seed there. For Christians in their own living, people are always watching you. You know, they're always watching you, especially if you claim certain things. But I want to argue they're not watching you the same way.
Okay.
Okay, they're not.
How are they doing?
They're not watching you the same way. They don't care what if you curse or not. They don't care if you drink or not. They don't care if all the things that used to be like don't smoke, don't chew, don't run with girls to do, all that kind of jazz.
Right.
If you personally don't like obscenities, if you don't like if you do not good with alcohol, that's fine. But don't act like that somehow means anything to a millennial generation.
Uh-huh.
That's not what they care about. Okay, to them, I don't know if they would think of it in exactly these terms, but that's the Pharisee saying, "Lord, I thank thee." It's a kind of putting
absolutely.
On. It's a kind of putting on of airs type thing.
Right.
What they're looking for is something
that
deeper.
Phony.
You know, they. This is one of the reasons why I think there are a lot of millennials who gravitate in right and wrong ways to like social, quote unquote, social justice issues, because for them it's like, I don't care if you like to have, you know, a drink on the weekend. Are you helping the poor?
Yeah.
Are you actually being good and loving to your neighbor?
Yeah.
You know, are you actually weeping with those who weep and, you know, rejoicing with those who rejoice, regardless of what language you may use in private or something like that? I mean, it's like the emphasis, I think personally it's a good thing, because it feels like the emphasis has moved away from a bunch of tangentials that, again, personally, probably still important, but substantively, we need to get back to like what actually matters, what actually counts. What does it actually mean to be Christ-like? For educators, we have to give foundational stuff, because that's where the substance is. As Christians, we really need to be Christ-like. We need to figure out what that actually means practically and strip off any sort of like little extra rules we put on top of it that just make us look like well-to-do people rather than actual like image bearers of Christ.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, I particularly like your idea about the foundational principles, because I think what we've tried to do, of course, here at the center is to go back and read the original texts and not just commentaries about them, right?
Yes.
So we read Dante himself, or we read Milton or Shakespeare or something.
And then we try to give what the actual Christian beliefs are about these things.
That's
and
right.
why it matters. And
That's
so
right. Why, engage with them honestly from a Christian perspective. I think so many educators today think that the way to get into, say, literature is to have a book of excerpts from all sorts of different works, you know, and read them just a little taste of all of them in order to get at. I mean, there's so much out there. They think, how can I manage to give them a real understanding of literature in such a short amount of time? I've got to give them 3 pages of Hemingway and 3 pages of Shakespeare. And we've gone the other way and said, we know there's too much out there for us to do. We know that on the front end. Let's pick a few things that we can dig in deep on. And deal with the actual whole of the thing. So we read the entire Augustine's entire Confessions, for example, not just the first bit.
And it's the digging deep thing that's what matters.
That's right. And that what it does is gives them a sense of where the foundations really are, where the solid rock is, and it gives them tools, hopefully, to be able to take that they can take from the experience with this book to other books that they should read too, right? We're not saying we've given you everything you need to read, but instead we're using this one or these few books in order to, and few bits of art and music to help you to gain a foundation so that you can continue this study for the rest of your life.
It is that desire for depth and substance that is the opportunity and the danger.
Yes.
Right? I've said this many a times in like other contexts of it. That desire for depth and reality is the opportunity and the danger. There's an opportunity. They're hungry, right? Mm-hmm. That's why I really emphasize that fantasy versus reality myth. Millennials are hungry for the real.
Mm-hmm.
They want it so bad. Established politics feels empty. Established kind of prosperity gospel, religion feels empty. The consumerist culture, that kind of culture feels empty.
Sure.
Digital life feels on its own empty. They want reality. And when you're starving for that, if real food comes along, you'll go for it. But if something that looks like real food comes along, you'll also go for
it.
So that's like the danger and the opportunity that is present to us.
Very good. Very good.
I guess we'll go into recommendations. We'll wrap it up. I feel like there's maybe more we could say, but that's probably a good primer, I guess, to work on. Recommendation-wise, the only thing I'm going to recommend right now is the... the interview by Rod Dreher. Am I saying that right?
Dreher.
Rod Dreher and Hans Boersma at the American Conservative. whether you like conservatism or not is moot, because I'm taking you there because of the interview, okay?
Yeah.
And you need to hear about Hans Boersma and his idea of like sacramental thinking.
Yes.
And how that can reach out to millennials and why he thinks so. But that interview is really good. I can't remember the title of it, but I'm pretty sure if you like Google the American conservative, Rod Dreher and Hans Boersma all as one thing,
right.
You'll find
right.
it. But it's
Very
an interview good. That Dreher did with Boersma.
Well, and I could recommend a book, too, talking about Boersma. That book I think you mentioned earlier, Heavenly Participation. Mm-hmm. I read that for a colloquium that he and I went to with Ken Myers and some other people. And it was fascinating, and it has a good sense for how the physical world is transcends itself, how the physical world can symbolically speak of those things that are beyond it. It would be a terrific thing, I think, if the millennials, in their search for what is authentic, would find that they need to reinstate a transcendent reality. They have to think of the world as including a transcendent reality, so that the material world isn't only material, it's material and it points beyond itself to some creator beyond itself. And that's part and parcel of both the sacramental view of the world and, I think, the place for the arts.
Yes.
So that actually leads me to something I'd like to talk with you about. In maybe not next time, but in the next few episodes, about beauty and about the nature of beauty, and how it is that it is the recognition of a kind of spark of connection between the physical world and the transcendent world.
Right.
Maybe that'll whet people's whistles.
I agree. I think there's a connection there. So Hans Boersma's book, Boersma, Boersma.
That's right.
His book, Heavenly Participation.
That's right.
My interview, Rod Dreher and Hans Boersma at the American Conservative. That's what we recommend.
Very good.
Thank you for joining us. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.